Blog Talk Radio.
And tonight we present a review on a very important recent book on the Hermetic tradition by Dutch author Jacob Slavenberg, entitled The Hermetic Link. Reviewing this book tonight will be a team effort between the host and our esteemed guest, Father Rufus Freeman Preston, who beat us to the punch and reviewed the Slavenberg book on his website 2 years ago. Well, how did we miss it? Well, no excuse, because it should not have been missed. Certainly there have been other surveys of the Hermetic tradition, usually combined with related elements such as Kabbalah, Rosicrucianism, magic, etc. But this is the best and the most complete tracing of the great Hermetic Gnosis from ancient Egypt through Alexandria, Haran, the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the so-called Enlightenment, and the present modern age. Slavenberg takes us from Zosimus to the Kabbalion in a sympathetic, very thoughtful, and comfortably philosophical style. He quotes Peter Kingsley, reality, frequently, and does as good a job as Kingsley in getting across the deepest meaning of the Hermetic mystery, the great I Am. Perhaps he does it better in that he uses excerpts from Hermes's texts to reveal the treasure that we ardent Hermetic devotees hold so dear. Whereas Kingsley, in reality, depended on pre-Hermetic Parmenides and Empedocles. Now, if all this is Greek to you, well, it shouldn't be. And Slavenberg goes a long way toward establishing the true and enduring magnificence of our venerable tradition. So tune in and get yourself hermetically sealed, preserved for your next incarnation. Now, we should have Freeman Preston calling in shortly, and when he does, we'll bring him on board. But let me...
Actually, I'm already here, folks.
Oh, you're already there, Frater Opus. Very good. Excellent. Okay, I have printed out here your review that you posted on your site. By the way, let me put in a plug for your review site. Freeman Preston is a real old friend of ours, and he has a site that is dedicated to reviews of books that relate to our tradition, and excellent, excellent website, very, very fine reviews. And would you give us the URL on that one, Freeman?
Yeah, it's my full name, Freeman Preston. That's FreemanPresson, and then .wordpress.com. I haven't paid the $17 to make it freemanpresson.com or something yet. I think I started... I started doing the book reviews not almost the same time I started listening to you on Blog Talk Radio, actually.
Well, that was about 4 years ago, and we've been going ever since, and you've been going ever since, and we've been back and forth and whatever. Now, all you have to do, by the way, if it's just Freeman Pressing Reviews on Google, and that'll get you there.
I noticed that I was like the top review that came back on Google for this one. I was
well, you should be. Now, I printed out your review on Slavenberg's book here. By the way, what do you think we should say, Slavenberg or Slavenberg? What would you? What do you think we ought to call it?
I'd pronounce his name Jakob Slavenberg.
Slavenberg. All right.
Yeah.
We'll go with that. Now, I have your review printed out here on a page and a half. Do you have it printed out? Because I thought you might just go ahead and read this review to get us started.
Oh, no, I didn't think to actually print it out. I can get to it very quickly.
While you're printing it out, I will start it, and then you can pick it up. You can pick it up when you get it printed out. All right.
Fair enough.
That way, I'm reading your review now, you can see whether you can catch up with me by the time I get done with the review. All right. Now this is what 2 years ago now, and I'm going to say this about that. You really beat me to the punch on this one. I saw it when it came out. I thought, oh, yeah, another book on the Hermetic tradition. And, oh, all right, I'll get around to it. But then I didn't. And sure enough, by the time I realized, how important it was, 2 years had slipped by. So here it is. Now, here's your review while you're printing out the rest of it. This Ibis title is a hefty paperback with a distinctive red cover decorated with one of the classic engravings of Hermes Trismegistus. I like this because it shortens most of the Where Did I Leave That Book episodes, and it is full of lovely old alchemical hermetic engravings and has four rich full color plates. Niederlander Jakob Slavenberg has a Ph.D. in cultural history and has written very extensively on Hermetic and Gnostic history and philosophy. There has been much interest in Hermetic matters in the Netherlands lately. This is in that strange category of scholarly books for a lay audience. At about 320 pages of main text and 1,124 footnotes, it's a significant investment of time to read. The most appreciative audience will be the students and practitioners of the Western esoteric tradition, who, like this reviewer, like to have as much background as possible and those with a deep interest in the history of ideas. There is an appreciative preface by fellow Nederlander Tejo van Denberg, author of Het Oud Egypte Pagramat van het Vorige Christendom, and how's my Dutch, Ancient Egypt, Cradle of Early Christianity, and Jung on Art. A brief introduction by the author in which he states his aim: to present a clear and recognizable line of thought that illustrates the uninterrupted progress of the Hermetic tradition up to the present, a prologue relating a visit to the site of ancient Hermopolis, and it sets a delightful precedent for many chapter and part beginnings throughout the book, where reminiscences of particular conferences and meetings lead into the matter at hand, joyfully personal, as in the story. The main text is divided into part one, The Secret of Hermes, interlog, The Fame of Hermes, part two, Hermes Unveiled. Yes, there's a nod to HPV's Isis Unveiled, and an epilogue. And there is a 24.5-page bibliography, a list of abbreviations, chronology, list of illustrations, and the magnificent expanse of 1,124 serially numbered endnotes with chapters identified. Awesome. Now, I feel strongly that... Okay, now you pick it up with I feel strongly.
All right. That a book like this was needed. A number of historians have apparently decided that the Hermetic tradition in Europe needs to be treated as a back formation because the specific texts of the Corpus Hermeticum were not available in Latin or vernacular between the destruction of the libraries of Alexandria and the publication of Ficinos Parmandris in 1462. There's also a nice rhetorical destruction throughout, but peaking on page 233 of attempts by materialist scholars to say anything meaningful about Hermes. The Hermetic link is unabashedly partisan, as mentioned, in favor of the existence and value of a continuing catena aurea of initiatory and philosophical Hermetics, which are Egyptian in content, but Grecian by form. For example, on page 133, we find a citation of Kingsley showing that the name Parmandris, rather than deriving from the Greek for herdsman, as was usually thought, may be a transliteration of Peme Neter Ra, the knowledge or gnosis of Ra. Unfortunately, the present volume suffers from weak copy editing, and I'll interject that it's also a translation from Dutch. So I don't know. I don't read Dutch, and I don't have the original, so I don't know how much of it is translation problems and how much is editing. But spelling errors are rife, and there are two or three paragraphs which cause this reader to retrograde over them more than once to be sure of the meaning. There are a few simple goofs like Sun and Mars sign of Aries on page 174, and a couple of instances of dates confusingly written as BC instead of AD. Also, the references are generally given without dates, which would sometimes cause problems, especially in references to obscure books and journals. On the other hand, Slavenberg has taught me to write decennia instead of decades, for I too am a word nerd, and I love the sound and Latinate feel of it. On the whole, this is a very valuable book for anyone involved in the Western esoteric tradition, philosophy, or the history of ideas. I'm going to find an honored place on my bookshelves for it as soon as I can find it again. Oh, right, red.
I will definitely say that
that was 2 years ago, and I write much better book reviews these days.
Well, I don't know. I think that's a pretty good one. Before we get away from this, what you just read, let me ask you. On this one you have up here, you say in a couple of instances of dates confusingly written as BC instead of AD. Now, do you happen to know right offhand? I'm not throwing one at you now because I haven't looked this up. What's the date for Zosimus?
That was one of the ones he was inconsistent about. Zosimus should be in the 300s A.D. and at one point in the book it said B.C., which is pretty impossible.
Uh huh. That really was a banger because I turned the dog in this page here. I want everybody to understand out there in radio land, we are not trying to trash Slavenberg. We love him.
Oh yeah.
But we just want to get we love him. We love the book and all of that, and we want everybody to read it. I don't want to lose this thing while we got it here, because I think it's just important. Zosimus I kind of thought he was AD, but here is this. He's quoting Zosimus here, and he says, this mention of the Son of God is remarkable. Even more remarkable is the fact that a bit further in the text, he names Jesus Christ, a surprising reference from the hand of a Hermetic philosopher and alchemist. Christ accompanies Adam and leads him to the place where the so-called light becomes formally dwelled. And preceding this, another story is told in which Adam, in addition to his bodily form, which can suffer, possesses a spiritual form, phos, or light, and in this form he's carried away by Jesus Christ, but powerless humanity sees only its material form, even though the spiritual Adam is always present in its subconscious and stands by it. Now, when I read that, I thought, wait a minute. And then I recalled, you know, that Zosimus was post-Christian, not pre-Christian. That one was kind of, aside from a few little things like that, this is really a, I think you'd agree, wouldn't you, Freeman? This is a magisterial book on the subject, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And, you know, when I reviewed it the first time, I didn't recognize the value of its encyclopedic coverage, you know, for what it really was. I have to admit that there were a lot of chapters where I looked at them and I said, okay, I'm familiar with this material, right? So I'm just going to, I'm going to read fast. Now, I essentially, there are very few books that I ever write a review of that I haven't read all of, but I have some really fast reading modes. You know, I can go 1,200 words per minute if I'm really wanting to. I kind of blasted through a lot of the chapters where the material was familiar. But then, if you think about it, wait a minute, why was that material familiar? It was familiar because what? I've read a dozen, maybe 40 different books on different parts of the tradition, and yet here it is all in one place. If I were writing a review again today, I would definitely come out and say that's one of the major values of this book is the way it traces the Hermetic Gnosis through all of these different eras and goes into most of the time just the right amount of detail.
I thoroughly agree with you there. And one of the examples where he is a little bit confused, but let's say maybe a little off-center in his coverage of Haran and the Sabaeans, but isn't it wonderful that he did? Because so many times we get books tracing the Hermetic tradition and they never realize the tremendous importance of that Sabaean connection. And he covered it. Yeah, and he covered it, and he traced. He did such a fine job of tracing the tradition all the way from, even before Alexandria on up through Alexandria and into Haran, into Italy, bringing the Pythagorean elements into it, and up through Pico della Mirandola. His chapter on Pico was just really, that was delightful. Spin, what a character. And of course, Ficino, and Ficino and Pico, and putting them in perspective. Getting on into the Rosicrucian phenomenon and into Masonry and bring this whole thing through. It's just really, really marvelous.
In the part where the tradition flowers again in Florence, he mentions some of the players who don't usually get a lot of press, like George Gemistos Plathon and Michael Psellus. These guys were important, and I mean these guys really, really, really got into specifically the Neoplatonic revival, but they went hand in hand. You know, Ficino was translating Plato when he got interrupted to translate Hermes.
Well, as we know, the Asclepius was considered, You know, that was considered to be part of the Neoplatonic revival along with the Hermetic revival, because the Asclepius, as Francis Yates pointed out, was the charge of dynamite behind behind Renaissance magic. And the Asclepius, yeah. Of course. I another thing that I really appreciate about Slevenberg is his acceptance and even advocacy of the genuine ancient Egyptian philosophical aspects of the Hermetic tradition that for so long scholars had been just poo-pooing this, you know, and marginalizing the Hermetic corpus because it was Greco-Egyptian, giving the impression that, oh, well, these people couldn't even read hieroglyphics, and what are they claiming to be Egyptian for? I think he...
Oh, absolutely.
Well, yeah, he showed us that the deeper aspects that were set forth in the pyramid text and all that, that they really did come into the Hermetic tradition, which they did. We know they did. And would you want to comment on...
I've got the quote on that. Let me read something real quick.
Okay, go ahead.
It's in the chapter on the Hermetic body. Before we go deeper into the content and spiritual meaning of the Hermetic writings, it is wise first to study the background and environment in which these writings were formed. Egyptian in content, but Grecian by form, means that Egyptian thought patterns and traditions have been poured into a Greek mold. You could almost say that in the first two centuries of our calendar, Thoth has been put into a modern jacket. A century ago, many scientists, by which he means scholars, started with Casaubon, but particularly Festugiere, stared themselves blind looking at this new jacket. All the attention paid to this specially measured suit resulted in the Egyptian Hermes becoming ultimately invisible.
Yeah, exactly. And the Greco-Roman... the another thing that he straightens out too, I think, is the composite nature of the Hermetic corpus, in that he ties it together because it has some dualistic Gnostic aspects, and then it has some Neoplatonic aspects, and he manages to get that in perspective. And I think
right.
Also another thing that I've very impressed with, and I mentioned in the abstract when we got going here, is that he's read a great deal more Peter Kingsley than I have. The only thing I've read on Kingsley so far is Reality and A Spear Waiting to Pierce You. But they're Kingsley written more material, which I want to get into. But Kingsley, as we know, well, that magnificent opus of his called Reality, he really, if you can get through 666 pages of Reality, then if you can even partially understand it, you will get the Hermetic great secret, and you will get the Hermetic Gnosis. You'll know it. You'll know what it is by the time you get done. But I think that one of the things that I'm really impressed with Slevenberg here is that he's managed to do the same thing, and he doesn't depend on Empedocles and Parmenides to do it. He does it right out of Hermes. He manages to right out of the Hermetic treatises themselves. So the depth of this, philosophically, the depth of this is really remarkable. So many people write books about Hermes and never, and you know when you're reading them, they don't really know what the ultimate secret of the Hermetic tradition is. But Slevenberg makes it quite obvious.
Yes, that's right. There's a hint every few pages that this man is not some dry scholar. Yes.
Yeah, so this is so much more satisfying in a deeper way than trying to wade through Scott's old Hermetic translations, and I think he even does a better job than G.R.S. Mead. I'm looking for a quote here. And I got one mark here. I said that this is one of the key quotes. He said, God is an infinite sphere whose center is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. This is, you contemplate this, and you almost have it. And he has another one here. If we truly say he was born in a deviating way, different from normal birth, as the Logos of God is born out of God, then one can see such, which we have in common with you, which Hermes, being God's messenger, calls the appearing Logos. And this is, of course, in relating the so-called Paraclete or the messenger. I think there's quotes in here that he has out of the Hermetic material that I've read, and I know you have too. I've read several versions of the Hermetic corpus, but Slavenberg has pointed out things to me that I couldn't remember were in there, and I was delighted when I found them. Another thing too, he has the alchemical. And the alchemical tradition, as we are aware, and the further we get into Hermetic studies, the more we become aware that the alchemical tradition does not match up very well with the astrological and the magical aspects of what we do, and especially not since the Kabbalah has been folded into and integrated into as of the 1300s, of course. This Kabbalistic structure that we now have fits even less comfortably with the alchemical analog, and he manages to clarify that to some extent.
Alchemy has always been something that it's very hard to get a grip on, and fit it. It's not neat and precise to the extent that the Kabbalah is, or even that astrology is. I mean, once you pick a variety of astrology to follow, at any rate, and. The literature is that's the hardest branch of the tradition to really get into because the literature is so crabbed, and you can tell you're looking at concealed secrets, and it's hard to know what they are. So you know anything that gives us a hint of how alchemy is really supposed to fit in there, I think is a big help.
Well, one of the things that helps a lot in Slavenberg's book has helped me a lot because I'm wrestling right now with how to get this Western psychic center system together and documenting the start of it and everything else. And Slavenberg's helped me in this respect. He has developed the. On his here, and it's one of the first times I've ever run across this. He has the actual Hermetic positioning of the planets, and describes how they originally, and this comes, of course, from ancient Egypt, very ancient Egypt, how they originally applied the astrological, the signs of the zodiac to the human body. As above, so below, the microcosm, macrocosm. So they originally established the idea of the signs of the zodiac in a human body, and they get this from Nuits, the star goddess, of course, that stretches over the heavens, and that became the Soma Sophia later in the Greco-Roman period. And so where do you put the planets in the human body on a situation like that? And they were primarily oriented with the zodiac, and alchemy went along with that too. But the they did have, and I never knew this before, he quotes here from Hermes, cure track that I hadn't read before. The human, my dear Damon, is called by learned men a universe. Since he resembles completely the nature of the world, indeed, at the moment of his conception, he receives from the seven planets a complexity of rays influencing each part of the body. The same occurs at time of birth based upon the position of the 12 zodiacal signs. Thus falls, as is said, the head under Aries, and the senses of the head are subdivided among the seven planets. The right eye falls to the sun, the left to the moon, the ears to Saturn, and the brain to Jupiter, the tongue and vulva to Mercurius, scent and taste to Venus, the arteries to Mars, and now, at a time of conception or of birth, one of the celestial bodies stands in a malevolent position. The result will cause a weakness in the part of the human, which corresponds to the heavenly star. Well, that was I never had run across that, but it is from an obscure tract. He really has dug into these lately discovered, and most of them have been lately discovered, tracts. And also, he makes use of Nag Hammadi. Had you read the discourse on the 8th and the 9th before you ran across it in Slavenberg?
Yes, I had. Actually, I had read I was just recently trying to remember where my copy of the Nag Hammadi Library, that fat paperback of the Nag Hammadi Library. I think it's hidden in my wife's craft room instead of being here in the temple study where it's supposed to be.
I kind of figured you had read it, but I had too. But I had forgotten that really was a Hermetic, and he even says so in the Claremont big green Alchemy book, you know. It even says right. That this is Hermetic, but I didn't realize at the time how important this is to cap off the Hermetic corpus. It really is
it's really exciting.
Yeah. And this was, you know, Slavenberg realized that this, the grasp, I think that the big thing that we're saying, and when you're both in agreement, his grasp of the whole scheme of things Hermetic is better than anybody else's that I've come across. He puts it all together, and running up closer to the time where we start getting our magical structure, although I notice he's not very impressed with the Golden Dawn. He doesn't seem to be terribly impressed with that. But he's,
He also mentioned the Hermetic Brotherhood of Luxor and Max Theon and all that. And managed to leave Pascal Beverly Randolph off, too.
Yeah. Well, I think he probably included, I don't think he was ignoring Randolph, but he probably just thought he was part of the Brotherhood of Luxor and let it go with that. But, anyway, though, getting into Masonry and into Rosicrucianism, I thought he's done a good job with that. And also, when bringing up into the modern era, I found it fascinating that he's quoting Sheldrake. Luther Sheldrake. Yeah. And Luther Sheldrake is a theosophist, as we know, but he's also he's also a scientist. And Sheldrake's. But one of the things that I also really really liked, and I don't want to forget. Without forgetting this, I've been saying for years that Descartes. It was the great dividing line we stopped having reverence for the human imagination with Descartes' proposition, and I've made you know I've 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 made a lot of hay on that, but I never really understood it as well as the way he describes it. And I'll read this right here. It's over on page 317. He says, the mechanical worldview, at the time of Kircher's birth, that's Athanasius Kircher, Rene Descartes was 6 years old. When Kircher died, Isaac Newton was 38. Factually, Descartes was therefore a contemporary of both. Newton is seen as the creator of the mechanical worldview. This is not entirely correct. From Newton on, the worldview became strongly influenced by discoveries in the field of mechanics, but Newton himself still had an eye for the metaphysical. He was also especially interested in alchemy, and it is true that through Newton's research and mechanical point of view, the world started to emerge in which it is assumed that all phenomena can be explained by the laws of mechanics. In this view, everything becomes predictable. Magic, alchemy, astrology, and the worship of God are no longer needed. According to French mathematician and astronomer Pierre Simon de Laplace, 1749-1827, scientific research would lead to a world mind capable of detecting the position and speed of each particle at any moment and calculating its future and past behavior at all times. Thus, nothing can occur that is new or unexpected. God became a remote mover once everything is set in motion in this dualistic paradigm. God is obviously portrayed as male, and he can rest on his laurels and rest for all time. But it was actually Rene Descartes who stands as the first propounder of the mechanical worldview. On November 10, 1619, Descartes experienced a vision of the angel of true reality that revealed a machine-like world ruled by mathematical laws without any inherent spontaneity or freedom whatsoever. This became the nucleus of mechanistic natural science. Descartes' theories of natural science were quite quickly rejected by Newton, among others, but his proposition that nature has no soul became a common assumption in the Enlightenment and is still true for most scientists. The philosophy of Descartes pulled the soul out of the totality of the natural world. The whole nature was lifeless, soulless, and sooner dead than alive, noted the groundbreaking British scientist Rupert Sheldrake. Has Robert Sheldrake there, of course, is Rupert. That's one of your typos. But I think that really, really does say it better than I've ever managed to say it. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, actually, there is another post on my blog that goes into this because it's very interesting. I mean, I knew about this business about, well, you know, Newton was an alchemist and so on, and Newton never really quite came out and said, I've got everything figured out, and the universe is purely mechanical. Laplace published this speculation about being able to calculate the entire future of the universe if you knew its state at some moment and had sufficient computing power. Now, a lot of people still act as if that's true, not realizing that 20th century science, starting in the early 20th century, started tearing that mechanical worldview down, and it's now completely in shambles. You have no place to stand if you want to try to point to modern science and say that it proves a materialistic worldview. You have no place to stand. It does not do any such thing. The universe is not predictable. The universe is unpredictable in principle, both at the quantum level and at the macroscopic level, because of the several theorems in chaos theory. You know, it's not just that we don't have a big enough computer. It is that the equations with the the nonlinear equations with all the feedback loops put you into a situation where the system can be deterministic and yet be not computable in principle. And then, of course, finding out that underneath it works on chance anyway, and quantum state vectors are going to collapse whichever way they want to. It just completely destroys the clockwork universe. Let's just put it that way.
Well, of course, and then on top of that, we have the hermetic great hermetic secret that God, the center of the universe, that the universe has no boundaries, and therefore the center is anywhere you happen to be, because God is inside you, and wherever God is, that's the center. Which means that literally you are God, and using the self principle, the idea of Parmenides came up with, that you've got consciousness and you don't know that anybody else has, you just assume it. So we know, and we spent a lot of taxpayers' money in that remote viewing program proving that Hermes was right. And we live in a holographic universe, and we can access it, and because we're at the center of it. And the Russians, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but the Russians have been doing some fantastic experiments with magic mirrors, by the way, I'm scientific. They're not doing this in robes. They're doing this scientifically. They are proving the hermetic proposition. And there is a book for people who still have this mechanistic, atheistic kind of view, totally materialist kind. And if you really, really want to get over it, and even if you've read Kingsley's Reality and you can't, you still can't get over it. A lady philosopher by the name of Marilyn Robinson has written a book. Zandria, can you find me that third, the green ray over there, so I can quote this specifically? Yeah. Oh, thank you. This Marilyn Robinson book, I don't know whether you've got it. You got it yet? But this one I use to back up Kingsley's Reality. If people have problems with this, and of course, if you read Kingsley's Reality and then you read this Marilyn Robinson book, which, by the way, got a very good review in the New York Times. I'll get to it in a minute here. And you still think that the universe is just some mechanical thing that rolls on, then there's no hope for you at that point.
Yeah.
You know, of course, also the books, read all of Michio Kaku. That ought to do it. If that doesn't do it, then there's no hope for you. But I'm trying to find, let's see here. Here we go. Absence of Mind, Marilyn Robinson, Yale University Press, 2010. The book's called Absence of Mind. And that one, it takes on the Rousseau Helvetius crowd and just leaves them lying in the dust. You get done with that. Let's just delve some more into this a bit. He actually has some good things to say about the Kybalion, and he does kind of seem like he's taken that in as one of the modern aspects of the Hermetic tradition. Do you think that he's justified in saying that?
Yeah, well, he does. He does kind of say that it's um, He does kind of say, he says something about it, about he's seeing as much theosophical influence on the Kabbalion, and of course I see it as being partly Hermetic and partly just New Thought.
It's New Thought, yeah, it's primarily New Thought, Christian Science, the next generation of Christian Science. And it was owes a lot to Herbert Spencer, and although they say Heraclitus in the Kabbalion, but in case our readers are not, our listeners are not familiar with the Kabbalion, this is a modern, very modern little philosophical book that says it's Hermetic. And it's been rather controversial because it was anonymous, and it's been attributed to a whole bunch of different modern adepts. But it talks about vibrations and polarities and all sorts of 19th and early 20th century scientific concepts. Swedenborg is kind of a I think he went through a hippie phase, and one thing I noticed, I wonder if you noticed that the one thing he seems to do to his ancient translations, everywhere he finds the word man, he changes it to human.
Right. Yeah.
Did you notice that? Yeah. And I see that, and there are a few times in there where that gets a little bit strained, and so I think he's a bit perhaps influenced by the feminist pagans in that regard, and that's all right, that's fine, but it does, you do notice it, especially if you've read a lot of Hermetic literature, that every time, because they used to refer to, oh sure, they meant, when they said man or mankind, they meant what they really meant was humanity or humankind.
Right.
That's true. So we'll forgive him for that. And also, he seems to he loved the musical Hair. He loved Hair. So he's kind of, in a way, I think. When I read this, I thought of our friend over there in Amsterdam, Peter Trump, who is an ardent Fariferian pagan, and Peter Trump, of course, helped us. Peter Trump got into the Ritter Museum, into the Amsterdam Museum, and actually copied the earliest version of the Craterapoa. They wouldn't let him Xerox it because it's fallen apart. So Peter had to get in there, and he had to, with a spatula and gloves and a respirator and a pen and copy this thing down. We published it, of course, in the Green Ray. But Peter is I will say a bit of a hippie, but kind of in that same mode. So I'll bet Peter. I haven't asked Peter yet, and if Peter's listening tonight, then he probably knows. Jacob Swedenborg. So what we ought to do is I'll email Peter. I should have emailed Peter before the show, but anyway, we'll see if we can make that connection. What else do you think?
You know, folks,
mention
I used to
this?
Always think Hair was a little bit silly. Back in the day, even though I was like 18 when it came out, but then there was one evening when, let's just say, I was having some psycho-spiritual trouble of a kind that was common during those years, and I brought myself out of it by chanting, "Let the sun shine." Let the sun shine. So after that, I stopped scoffing at Hair. You know, it saved me a lot of trouble.
Well, I think Hair was fine, and in the age is the age of Aquarius and all that. You know, even some of those tunes, you couldn't get them out of your head, and they were good.
Well, absolutely.
I thought I'd mention it because I want to put Swedenborg in perspective. He's just, is he not some old stuffy old scholar, you know? He's a guy that was out there
you know, probably doing it. Probably does a little magic too, you know, and it makes you more human. And certainly,
yeah, I love the way he interjects the personal in here. All the way, something in every chapter is personal and expresses his relationship to the material. That just makes it so much easier to read.
Yeah, he just really, you have a feeling, it's a friendly book.
And
I'm going to mention, while we're on the subject, that another book like it, that he only refers to once, but there's another book like it that we ought to mention while we're on the subject. And this is a book called The Eternal Hermes, subtitled From Greek God to Alchemical Magus, by a French author, Anton Favre. That's F-A-I-V-R-E, Favre.
Right. Yeah, that's
and it's
on
translated
my list.
Yeah, by Jocelyn Godwin, and it's 1995, and I have Fred Adams' annotated copy here. And this covers much the same ground, although it doesn't go quite. It doesn't have the scope. It does not have the scope of, and it's more pedantic. It doesn't have that, but it's a nice reference book. It's got a lot of detail, and Fred obviously really liked it. I thought it was a little bit dry, but. And however, this book covers the same ground. Have you read this one yet? The Eternal Hermes.
No, that one's still on my wish list. But you mentioned Jocelyn Godwin. That reminded me of something I wanted to make sure to mention. There are a few places in the Hermetic Link, like in the chapter on the mystery of the self, where some of the some of the like the ancient vowel chants are recorded.
Yeah,
and that turns out to be an interesting hint of something deep and old. Apparently that was one of the theurgical practices in the Egyptian temples.
Oh yeah,
and Godwin himself has written a book about it, The Mystery of the Seven Vowels in Theory and Practice. You know, Godwin.
That's right.
Godwin is an expert on this material, plus he's a musicologist, so he was the perfect person to write this. He was talking about, of course, relating the vowels to the seven heavens and the seven planets and so forth, and he gives, unfortunately, there's no one answer to, oh, yeah, we figured out how the ancient Egyptians did it, but there's several self-consistent methods that he gives, and he also gets into he's not the only one who's been chasing this. He can identify that certain composers like Debussy, and then later on Stockhausen and so on had obviously dug into this to some extent, but you know, Godwin's the right guy to do it because
Godwin is a musicologist along with being a scholar of the Western tradition, and a prodigious output and wonderful scholar, great translator. He translated the whole Hypnoerotomantia, and one of these times we ought to have a show on the a 2-hour show on the Hypnoerotomantia.
Absolutely, and also, Godwin also wrote a guidebook to that.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Because there was that popular novel, The Rule of Four, that was based on sort of like giving a Dan Brown treatment to the Hypnoerotomachia.
Yeah, that's right.
Before Dan Brown.
I'm convinced.
That's
myself.
A wonderful book that he wrote about this, talking about, well, this is what they did in the novel, and this is what it actually looks like in the book, and so on. It was such a wonderful book. I don't have it. I got it out of the library, but it was a great.
That's a masterpiece, and I have a suspicion myself that was the model for the Portus Lucas in the Ninth Gate or the Club Dumas. Although the Portus Lucas was supposed to be demonic, But basically, right. that was the kind of book they were talking about. The Hypno-Rodomontia fits that perfectly. Yeah, we need to do a show on that. But next week, right along the line of what you were talking about, and have you read Kenny Ferguson's Music of Pythagoras yet?
That's another one on my wish list, Pope.
Well, that's what we're going to do next week. So you beat me to Slavenberg, and I beat you to the Music of Pythagoras. And
you're the reason my wish list is in the shape it's in. You keep coming up with more great books
that I just really have
to read.
After you trumped me on this Slavenberg book, I appreciate that. So we're going to do Kenny Ferguson. Now, Kenny Ferguson, I'm sure people don't realize, they look at the picture of her on the back flap, and here's this cute-looking little baby-faced little girl. This woman is an intellectual giant and a musicologist, a philosophical musicologist on the level of Godwin. And she has this book, Music of Pythagoras, which it does very much like what Slavenberg has done, but she's tracing the Pythagorean, which of course is one of the main origins of the Hermetic tradition, as we know, and she's tracing that all the way up through. All the way up to Michio Kaku and Hawkins and the rest. So before we sign off, give us your website information again, and let's get our listeners to reading your excellent reviews on books on this subject. Okay, so where do they want to go?
Oh, okay. Well, it's freemanpresson.wordpress.com. And also, my last, I've also started reviewing for spiralnature.com. We've got, about my last three book reviews have been on there. Now, when a review of mine goes up on Spiral Nature, I announce it on my own blog. So you won't miss anything by going to freemanpresson.wordpress.com.
Okay.
I'm really enjoying working with Psyche over at Spiral Nature. I think she's built something really nice.
Well, good. I'm going to check it out myself.
Yep.
And meanwhile, next week, the Music of Pythagoras, and we might actually have a little music along with it. And yet, I don't have a monochord right now, but I might have one before. I have something like one before next week. So next week, Music of Pythagoras. And meanwhile, thank you so much, Freeman, for coming on board. And so until next week, good magic.
Good magic, folks. Thank you very much.